Welcome to Awakening Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, depending on the part of the world that you're calling in from. My name is Amit Dungrani, and I'm really excited to be your host for this week's Global Awaken Call. Today, we have a remarkable guest speaker with us, Rajini Bakshi, whose presence embodies the spirit of our calls. By her very nature and vocation, Rajini is a storyteller. For over 40 years, she's used the power of storytelling, both in her role as a journalist and an author, to shine a spotlight on people, ideas, and actions that are often overlooked by today's media and mainstream publishers. For example, in one of her books, Bapukuti, she explored the lives of 12 people who have turned their backs on lucrative professions to embark on a search for ways to evoke political and social transformation. And while these individuals may not call or consider themselves Gandhians, these activists have found ways and come to the same conclusions that Gandhi did over a half a century ago. Rajini's writings are profound journeys into the intellect and spirit. Her conversations reflect her deep search for truth, overlaid on the breadth of her knowledge and experiences. Today, we'll be diving into both her personal story and the stories of the incredible people she's come across and written about. We have the great pleasure of having Rahul Brown as our moderator, and I thought we could kick off the circle with you sharing some of your own thoughts on today's theme and on your excitement to have Rajini here as our guest today.
Absolutely. Thanks for that introduction, Amit. Well, you know, I just think that the topic that I feel like Rajini has really devoted her life to is so live and so relevant for modern times, where we see market forces dominating the world, really. And even in places where market wasn't predominantly the driving force, we see it creeping into every aspect of our lives. And this is juxtaposed with a world where many of us, especially in the service-based ecosystem, are very much connected with kind of something that's moving in the other direction, a return to perhaps what preceded the market, especially with an intrinsic desire to serve, and involved in many experiments along the spectrum of what now might be considered alternative ways of doing things, whereas from another lens, they might be the original way of doing things. So I'm just on the edge of my seat to have this conversation with Rajini, and so delighted that you can be joining us.
Thank you, Rahul.
Absolutely. So, Rajini, Amit did a phenomenal introduction to you, and I don't want to dive into that as much as use our time to learn more about you and your work. And, you know, as I was reading about your life and work, I get the feeling that it's been a rigorous search for sort of truth and meaning coupled with this desire to share your discoveries with others that's really animated your life. And I think that, you know, a lot of people have this intrinsic need for meaning, but it's often really heightened when people experience something difficult in their lives. I'm curious about whether the family trauma of partition played a role in catalyzing this quest for meaning and sort of reconnecting with grassroots India in your own life.
Thank you, Rahul. Actually, it was very much in the background. Of course, and we can talk about that later perhaps, because both sides of my family, my mother's family and my father's family, did come at the time of partition from Peshawar in Lahore to India, and then my parents were married in 49. But actually, my father was among the very lucky ones, because he already had a master's degree, and so he was part of that first generation that benefited the most from independence. And so for me, actually, I think the starting point was the realization, very, very palpable realization, that I had a life of great privilege, because I grew up in different parts of the world. When I was 10, my father was sent to the Philippines to work with the Asian Development Bank. So, you know, for 6 months we were there. And then a year later, he was sent. He was in the Reserve Bank of India, actually. But because he was an agricultural economist, he became part of what I used to think of as the international development bureaucracy. And so by the time I was 11, I found myself in Jamaica, West Indies, where in, so we landed there in 71, when a man called Michael Manley was just coming to power in Jamaica, and his slogan was, love is the word. And I know today it sounds impossible for people to believe that a politician with the slogan, love is the word, came to power, you know, in newly independent Jamaica, but it was a very big formative influence for me, because I don't know how and why, I was interested in politics from a very young age. And so I grew up in a life of great privilege, and honestly, I think it must be it's a kind of grace to have felt the awareness of what this privilege was worth in the sense that, you know, that it gave me a sense of feeling that very few people are given this kind of cushion in life, and so it must be used for something truly worthwhile and truly meaningful, because I felt so grateful not to have to worry about physical survival or you know, climbing a ladder in order to survive. So really, that was my starting point.
That's beautiful, almost as if it was the gratitude for such an abundant life that made you feel like you wanted to really pay it forward to everyone else.
That's right. Also, in the mid-70s, revolution was still something that young people, you know, thought was necessary. I certainly did. That, you know, and I knew that there was so much in India that, you know, needed to be changed, and that so much inequality and injustice that had to be changed, I mean, made better. And so I was dying to grow up and come back to India and, you know, jump into the fray. But by the time I got back, which was in 75, I came back to India to do my bachelor's degree. I enrolled at Indraprastha College in Delhi. But I landed exactly a week after the emergency had been declared. And so that was then the next big event in my life. I mean, it didn't physically or emotionally touch me in any direct way, but simply to live in that fear, atmosphere of fear and restraint and anxiety that, you know, you were not anymore living in a free country. That had a very, very big influence, and I think gave me a kind of, in my teens, a sense of resolve and commitment to what only later I learned to call the open society.
That's interesting. Yeah, we can talk about emergency perhaps a little bit later, but I wanted to get back to this question of partition again, because it's really interesting that for many people that event was sort of part of the collective or individual trauma of their families, and yet in your case it seems like as a result of your father's education it was almost a gift that created another lifestyle for you, which was the foundation of this gratitude. So I'm curious if that is how Gandhi ended up becoming an inspiration in your life. And if it wasn't that, how was it that he became an inspiration for you?
Oh, okay. So just to clarify that I think our lives may have been just as privileged even if partition had not happened. I'm saying that because of my father's advantages, he was well placed to survive the experience better than a lot of people who had to struggle much harder. And it did have it was very much part of our childhood consciousness, I would say, for all the people young of my generation, all my cousins. But see, the most important thing in our family, and I think it was so for many families, I have many friends who came out of similar histories, personal histories, is that we grew up being told it was an enormous human tragedy on all sides, and only Gandhi was right. That Gandhi alone understood what a horrific mistake the whole conflict was. Not just the fact of partition, but all that built up to it. The idea that we were two separate nations, and then the fact of becoming two separate countries. So really, Gandhiji was just part of the air we breathed. And in the way that whenever my father explained to me that it was a terrible human tragedy, both sides were to blame, and Gandhiji alone could see that the only way out of this was love and nonviolence. So really, in a sense, I suppose I owe that connection to my father. For example, I was 9 years old when my father told me about the Holocaust. So I knew about the Holocaust in Europe, the Jewish Holocaust, long before I, you know, read history books. But in the same spirit of, sharing his anguish that such things had happened and they must never happen again.
Right. So you mentioned that in the 70s was the first time you sort of made your way back to India. I'm curious if you ever ended up visiting your ancestral homes in Lahore or Peshawar.
No, unfortunately, that's never happened. My father very much wanted to go back, but unfortunately, it never, visas, etc., have always been an issue. And maybe I sometimes wonder that, he had a kind of he had a conflicted view of this. A part of him wanted to go back and a part of him was afraid to go back and find how much it would have changed. My mother, on the other hand, has never wanted to go back. She still, feels the trauma as a hurt. From which we have recovered and we have moved on in life, but it's something that is still associated with so much sadness that she has never wanted to go back.
Sure.
And so I know I want to go back, of course, but the opportunity has never come up, and I must confess that I've clearly not worked very hard to make it happen.
Right. Yeah.
But I do want to mention. Yeah, sorry?
Sorry, go ahead.
An uncle of mine did it recently. He actually found, he has a Pakistani friend who was able to connect, create a phone connection for him with the ancestral village, not just our urban bases. And then because that friend, the friend in Lahore, had a wedding, his son was getting married, and on the basis of that wedding invitation, my uncle was able to get a visa. And he went and he shared the photos of how that village welcomed him back. They lined up at the entrance of the village with flowers and incense, and it was incredibly beautiful how these people who had no connection with him, he was 3 years old when he left Pakistan. And but the memory, there were two elders still in the village who remembered our families. And so because of their memories, you know, many people of the village turned out to welcome him like a, you know, long-lost brother returning home.
Right. It truly is remarkable how ordinary people everywhere just don't really identify with the kind of boundaries and barriers that we've erected in our political dialogue and our maps. But it's beautiful to hear that story. So, Rajini, like, professionally, you occupy what you call this sort of fertile ground between journalism and activism. And I get the feeling that the industry of journalism itself sort of prevents people from being both passionately involved and then also storytelling around the work they're involved with. Can you talk a little bit about this tension in the field and how you seem to have managed to overcome it or sidestep it?
Could you explain that tension a little more? I didn't quite get it.
Well, you know, we tend to think of the standard of journalism as being one that's sort of impartial and removed. And that seems to be at odds with kind of being an activist, kind of being part of the movement that you're chronicling. And yet I feel like you have inhabited that space and managed to not only bring forward tremendous contributions in your work and your scholarship, but also done it in a way that's not been kind of counter to either of those fields. You've managed to remain in integrity with both the journalism side of this and the activism side. So I'm just fascinated with how you've managed to pull that off, because it seems like it's the sort of holy grail of what anyone who wants to be a journalist would really go after.
So I was trained as a journalist in the U.S. I went to college at George Washington University at the Columbia School of Arts and Sciences, where they have a journalism school. And it's absolutely right that, you know, in Journalism 101, they teach you about objectivity. But one of the first exercises that I remember we did was that we were all sent out to, you know, cover something, and inevitably, you know, the teachers know, of course, that when people come back, all 10 people will come back with a different story. They've been to the same event, but you will come back with 10 different versions of it. Which, of course, you know, Gandhiji used to talk about very evocatively with his metaphor of the elephant. That, you know, there are, if you have 10 blindfolded people who are, you know, given different parts of the elephant to touch, everybody thinks it's something else. So really, I have felt that there is absolutely no such thing as complete objectivity. But what I think true journalism means, to me at least, is a complete integrity with as much as you can the totality of the picture, which is never really humanly possible, but that's why I mean as much as is humanly possible, to try and give a range of the emotions and the power plays and the aspirations, all the dimensions of the story as much as you can. But inevitably, it is still from a vantage point. And so as long as I am not artificially or wrongly misrepresenting any aspect of it, and that's often very difficult. It is a struggle because that's a very big risk. That, you know, because you can only see anything from a particular vantage point, you may inadvertently misrepresent either an idea or a person or a situation or a position on an issue. So it is a constant struggle. I've only tried to do that by always remembering that there isn't a truth, there are multiple truths. And to try and keep, you know, all if you may allow me, in the language of Star Trek, keep all hailing frequencies open in the hope that you pick up as many of the signals and many of the messages of multiple truths that are coming your way. I don't know if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I feel like that's a great response to the journalism side of it. I'm curious about how the activism spirit then got ignited and what the kind of framework of guidance was around remaining in integrity with the activism when you also have to inhabit this world of journalism.
Yeah. So there were times when I, in the 80s, late 80s, when I was I was involved on the peripheries of the Narmada Bachao Andolan and other such struggles. There were certainly moments when this, you know, raised awkward and difficult questions for me, both in terms of, on both sides. You see, in the journalistic circles, I was treated as an activist, and in the activist community, I was treated as a journalist. And I must say, I more or less muddled along. I didn't really have any very clear answers, except always to be clear in my own mind and in my own heart that I was at no point pushing any vested interest. I was not there to, in either case, whether it was journalism or activism, not there to push or, promote any sectarian interest, but to try and work for the core values of democratic participation, justice, fairness. And I know it sounds very vague when it's put like this, but maybe as we go along, some example will come up which might illustrate what I struggled with. But it was a struggle.
Would it be fair to say that there was some sort of a hunger or a desire around this concept of sort of nation building that was perhaps a bridge between these two worlds of journalism and activism, and in particular your own drive to kind of be at that intersection at the grassroots in India?
Yes, except that in this case, nation building was very much in the kind of internationalist sense. By that I mean not necessarily the Communist Party version, notion of international, but universalist in the way that Gandhiji was, where he was, because by the mid-80s, I began to get drawn into a whole stream of thought and action in India, which, like Gandhiji, was critiquing the dominant development model and the notion of civilization that it is based on.
Mm-hmm.
So more and more, the work that many of us were doing through the late 80s and all of the 90s was focused on those more fundamental civilizational issues. And at that time, we used to call it alternative development. And then, of course, in 1992, after the Rio summit, it became a mainstream global term, and it's now called sustainable development. But a lot of the activities and networks that I have been engaged with certainly have a local, regional, and a national focus, because that's the immediate theater of action. But the vision and the perspective is planetary, because we know that these issues will either be resolved on a planetary scale or they won't be resolved at all.
Right. Right. So with all of this as the backdrop, you wrote of arriving at Sevagram, which is Gandhiji's last home, as one of your inspirations. I'm very curious about what happened when you showed up that was so moving for you.
Well, it's very difficult to describe. I must also add first that I really seriously got drawn into the historical Gandhiji's life only after I read Louis Fisher, rather late in life. You know, I must have been about 23 or so when I read that book. And around the same time, I read an article by Claude Alvarez, who had been to Bapu Kuti at Sevagram. And it was one of those very inexplicable feelings that I had, that I just have to go there. Something called to me. And it's very difficult to describe, but it was like such a feeling of coming home. And at that time, there was no thought. It was not at a level of thought. It was much more visceral. But I just wanted to be there. And it wasn't that there was a very active community immediately at the ashram. There were some friends, and there was different people doing different things who I then became friends with. But clearly there was something almost at a metaphysical level which drew me there. And it was much, much later, I think my some almost 7-8 years later that it struck me one day while I was at Sevagram. There's a linking thread to many of the people that I know and whose work I admire. And that's how Bapu Kuti happened, the book.
Right. And so, you know, in your book, Bapu Kuti, you're chronicling the lives of these modern activists who kind of reached the same conclusions about social and economic problems that Gandhi did. And that, of course, was ultimately the inspiration for the film Swadesh as well. I'm curious about whether there was an activist amongst these dozen that really stood out for you, and why?
Well, there were many, but I think 2-3 people were very key in that project. One of them was Vibha Gupta, who's still living at Madan Sangrale in Vardha nearby. The other was Vinu Kale, who was doing some amazing, he was an architect by training, but he had given that all up to become an activist on the issue of bamboo. And the third person was Anand Bapat, who together all of them were part of something called the Academy of Young Scientists. And it was really meeting them and it was actually at Vibha's house on her dining table that the idea of even writing Bapu Kuti I articulated for the first time. And I'm just trying to remember in a few sentences. I think it was just their dogged dedication that they had been asking some fundamental questions and doing so in the spirit of dialogue, not just involving people at the grassroots who were struggling with survival issues, but at the other end of the spectrum with the elites in metros. And this ability to stretch your work, I mean, your thinking and your action to the entire spectrum of society, I think was a deep inspiration for me. It's very common for people to work at either one or the other end.
What do you mean by that?
You either work, you know, in the mainstream elite circles, or you work at the grassroots. Mm-hmm. But this was a bunch of friends that were trying to work across the spectrum by taking the issues of one sector to the other.
Almost like a cross-pollination between the two worlds.
That's right. They were attempting to do that, and they had moderate success, but subsequently many other people did do that with quite a great deal of success. And in fact, I think that is what is most dramatically manifest in service space.
Oh. Tell me more.
Well, because, one of the key elements of the Gandhian approach to transformation is that the struggle or the process of transformation must have room for everyone, from the prince to the pauper. Mm-hmm. And based on my limited contact with various service space networks in India, I can see that a very wide range of people from very different dimensions and levels of society are engaged in this. And of course, Nipun personally, I think, traverses many universes. And it's not just personal. I mean, through his work in service space. So that is very precious.
Right. You know, it just as sort of Gandhiji's work seems to be quite broad and has many strands, I'm sure that many of these folks are sort of like spokes from the center of a wheel of influence where Gandhiji may sit at the middle. Beyond kind of that element of Gandhiji and perhaps the determination that they had in cross-pollinating their various worlds, would you be able to identify any kind of common threads amongst the folks that you have chronicled in Bapu Kuti?
I think the first and most important is they were all people who were seekers rather than knowers. They were not claiming to have all the answers that they were then, you know, willing to enforce, which is unfortunately what happens to many revolutions. It happened to many revolutions of the 19th and 20th century, when you have one fixed vision and it is to be people have to comply with it, or that you are so convinced that that one particular way will liberate human beings from their oppression and the injustice. And so then the very people who want the better world become the enemies of the open society. And now, I think all the people that appeared in Bapu Kuti had this quality of almost a kind of tentativeness, while their commitment to the fundamentals was completely unwavering and, in a sense, non-negotiable. But a tentativeness and an openness in the methodology and the refusal to walk down any path that would, in which their behavior would become arbitrary. That's the key.
Would you say that there is a difference then between these folks who are sort of the modern Gandhians and perhaps those who are more identified as traditional Gandhians, where they did grasp kind of one of the many strands of development thinking or self-rule perhaps that Gandhiji had spoken about and worked towards?
You know, that's very difficult. I think it's difficult and maybe not fair to frame it quite like that, because different individuals have lived and practiced these ideals in many different ways. Yes, it can be objectively said that many of the what shall we call uniformed Gandhians maybe became very routinized, etc. But I met many of them who were just as inspiring as, in fact, more inspiring in some cases than my own contemporaries. So I think let's beware of any generalizations in this respect. And by the way, you know that if Gandhi's own journey remained incomplete, and in many ways he was disappointed towards the end, you know, with his own journey on nonviolence. So I would just say that people travel in the best way they can, and I try very much to avoid making judgment in either way.
Sure, sure. Certainly they all must come from a sort of a wholeheartedness about expanding well-being for others. And you, of course, have written a work called The Economics for Well-Being. I'm curious about what you identify are the key elements of an economics of well-being.
So that particular book, it's actually a booklet published by the Center for Education and Documentation in Bombay and Bangalore. It was a prelude to the longer book that I wrote later called Bazaars, Conversations and Freedom. And basically, the journey began like this. For two decades, the 80s and 90s, I had been part of various activist networks that were working for a more humane development, a more people-centric, a more locally empowering development. And yet it was also evident by the end of the 90s that these struggles were sort of, you know, caught in a cul-de-sac. They were not showing signs of making any very vast progress that would, scale up, not only scale up that kind of thinking and work, but make a really paradigm-shifting kind of, have a paradigm-shifting impact. And so that's when I began to study this concept of the market. And I realized that what has basically happened, and of course many people have done tons and tons of work on this, so I was basically just chronicling that work. And Herman Daly's work was a big influence in this, as of course of E.F. Schumacher much earlier, that it is only in the 18th and 19th century that in the Western world, this idea develops that the political economy can be separated from morality and community, from ethical, moral priorities of communities. The two things can and should be separated. And so one of the outcomes of this separation is the belief that as long as you put people's material needs in place, you know, then the rest is for them to work on. But that's not actually how life, real life, works. And the social, spiritual, moral, ethical, and material dimensions are actually completely dovetailed. So economics for well-being is a very broad term for different kinds of ways. There are schools of thought, there are models, there are specific areas of work which people are pursuing in order to reintegrate this entire continuum.
So I'm curious about how those various elements are able to be integrated without a sense of kind of legislated economy or legislated morality, right? When you take in the broader consideration of what it means for well-being to be there across all of these spectrums and then try to systematize it, is it possible or how does it actually work?
So at the moment, you're absolutely right. Unless the governance structures through which power is flowing in societies across the world, unless they are changed, the kinds of efforts that are made at the grassroots can only have local and limited impact. And there, my main emphasis for quite some time now is that nothing represents this problem more than the worship of GDP and the very concept of GDP. So actually, the fact that the limitations of GDP were recognized long ago, Okay, by the late 1980s, even the World Bank acknowledged that, yes, the gross national development or, gross domestic product, this is not the final word on the state of a nation or a society. And so the Human Development Index was created in the early 1990s. But as long as these two measures, and then we have separate measures for environmental well-being. As long as these three dimensions remain separate, there is no hope of reintegration. And so far, the only country that has broken free of this is Bhutan with its gross national happiness index. And of course, there are many non-state entities, research groups, activist groups that have created these alternative and integrated indexes. The Happy Planet Index is one that's worth looking at. There's a redefining progress work that is done out of Canada. But unless governments change, abandon the GDP as a measure, and create a new and integrated measure, we are going to have this, pure materiality will continue to overwhelm all other forms of well-being, the quest for all other forms of well-being. And which is not to say that the material dimension is unimportant. Certainly not. Especially in a country like India, where some 500 million people have not even entered, they haven't even gotten to the point where they can press their nose against the glass of the shop that they are locked out of. So I'm not at all underestimating or undervaluing the importance of fixing the material side of life. But we are not going to do it with this measure of success.
Certainly, certainly.
Right.
I'm hearing an echo. I'm wondering if you are as well.
No, I'm okay.
Okay, great. In Bazaar's Conversations and Freedom, you've written about the problems of this market system, perhaps in contrast to the Bazaar system. What is fundamentally different about the Bazaar system, and how does it have an opportunity, or does it have an opportunity to offer any sort of lasting change in the face of our kind of dominant market system?
So my journey began by, I began historically to look at how old market exchange was, and I found that other than hunters and gatherers, all other forms of social organization have had a marketplace, right? Even tribal societies have had floating market spaces, because I think in many parts of the world there are indigenous people who are not hunter-gatherers. They have settled agriculture, etc. And apart from people we can watch and learn from today, we know from historical evidence that first of all, you are absolutely right what you said in the introduction, that gift exchange, mutual aid precedes everything. There is a 4,000-year gap between the appearance of settled agriculture and anything like a commercial transaction, even in Mesopotamia, for which we have apparently the best records because we are able to decipher the scripts. So then for almost two millennia, more than that, there is market exchange that is rooted and embedded in society. By that I mean that society was dominant, social needs and mores and frameworks were the basis of deciding what and how systems of exchange would operate. Now, this is not to suggest that by 21st century standards these were anywhere acceptable or perfect, because most of these societies were very hierarchical, and there were all kinds of social and other inequities. But the difference is that capital was not dominant. Capital the domination of capital begins from roughly the 16th, 17th century in Europe, when in fact money as we know it now is taking shape. And so what I mean by bazaar is that socially embedded systems of exchange, which include gift and commercial, in which there is room for, in fact, even celebration of notions of sufficiency, cooperation, co-creation. And the opposite of that is the market culture, where greed and fear are seen as the drivers, and that's celebrated because it is believed that if it wasn't for this great driving energy of greed and fear, we would not have enough economic dynamism, and so the whole world would sort of wind down into everybody being poor, which is a completely wrong belief.
Right. And yet that wrong belief has become so dominant.
Yes, but so much opposition to it all along, and I think we live in a time where maybe there is more creative energy in that opposition than ever before, which is not to say that, you know, it's going to, turn around in any definite way, but at least the effort is fully on, and, you know, the struggle is fully engaged.
Right. Rajini, switching streams a little bit, in your bio, you also wrote that one of your inspirations was being found by the Ramcharitmanas. What are they, or what is that, and what's the story of how it affected you?
So the Ramcharitmanas is the story of Rama told by in absolutely divine poetry by Tulsidas, Goswami Tulsidas, who was a mystical saint who lived in Banaras. He was a contemporary of Akbar. And I was found by it because it had actually been in my family tradition, but, you know, my mother read it, I didn't, until the great trauma of the Babri Masjid being demolished in 92 December, followed by very brutal riots, many parts of the country, but in Bombay, they happened in two phases. First in December 92 and then almost the whole of January 93, the city came to a complete standstill. There was so much rioting and killing. And in this very traumatized frame of mind, I was advised by a cousin of mine that I should actually read the Ramcharitmanas. And I did. So I felt found by it, though actually it was, you know, more like you're drowning and somebody, and suddenly next to you, that floaty tube comes along. So it was like that. And I think I knew from like page 4 or 5 that it was going to be a great life changer for me, because Tulsidas ji begins by honoring the Dusht. Dusht is the evil one. Saying, I also bow to those who do evil, because they too are a form of the divine. And only by embracing the totality can I fully honor the divine. And this embracing of both the sattva and the tamas. We have this, there are three, creation happens when these three gunas manifest themselves, sattva, rajas and tamas. So it was Tulsidas, by bowing to the dusht, to the evil, who taught me that I was wrong to be, suffering from this feeling of aversion and fear towards those who were rioting, those who were killing people. And instead, you have to find ways to see that they also are manifestations of the same divinity. At least, then there's some possibility of reaching out.
That inspiration means a lot to me, and I know to many other callers, especially given the light of the political climate of the United States right now. So thank you so much for sharing that. You also wrote about Swami Vivekananda and Ramakrishna kind of having an impact on you. Can you share a little bit more about that?
So it was in the same period. Another friend suggested that I spend some time getting to know Vivekananda, and my initial motivation for doing that was very political, because I knew that Vivekananda is an inspiration both to the secular activists and to the advocates of Hindutva, two opposing forces. So I began first to read him for that reason, but very soon this reason seemed very superficial, and it opened up a whole new universe of understanding. I'm not saying I agree with every last word that Swamiji says, but the core inspiration was again very much like the reading of Ramcharitmanas. It was an energy charge that is still carrying me. And then, of course, once you've met Swami Vivekananda, he is bound to lead you to his guru, right? Who is Ramakrishna Paramahansa.
Right.
And
Beautiful.
While I have the mic for a moment, I thought I'd jump into a question. And Raji, this is something that you had shared earlier in the call. You mentioned that your father had told you about the Holocaust when you were 9 years old. And so I guess on behalf of our callers, many of who are parents like myself or perhaps educators, how did he approach such a difficult topic with, a girl that at such a tender age, and obviously it stayed with you, and I'm sure there are other lessons in history that he taught you, but I'm how did that even arise and how he approached that?
Yeah, I don't remember what the context was, how it came up, but basically what I remember being told is that there was a place called Germany, and where at some point this thing had happened, that people were crammed into rooms and they were gassed, and it was a horrible, horrible mistake, and how could it ever happen? Nobody has been able to figure that out. This kind of sense of disbelief, and yet knowing it to be true. When you say about parents and children and, how much more difficult it seems today, I think that, when I was a child, there was a very different sense of what we thought children could handle. I think we live in a time now, maybe because there's so much other sensory overload. See, I'm the last, perhaps, generation that grew up without television. I'm now 58. And so I really grew up completely without television. And so maybe it's because we live in an age of so much sensory overload that parents have to be more protective towards their children. But I grew up in a different age where we didn't think children were so fragile.
So perhaps then maybe also this is the reason why storytelling is somewhat natural to you because you didn't have that overload from TV or computers or tablets that young children are often playing.
I don't know. I mean, I see my 15-year-old niece, you know, writing away, or she's on some internet group where, you know, she writes stories and they write stories. So I don't know. I think technology may be growing stories also. So we'll have to leave that one open.
Absolutely. You know, I'm curious, you know, and I know that you and Rahul had touched on some of this earlier, but, you know, in Bapukuti and the individuals that you had covered, you know, in their various stories, I mean, I guess it's been almost now 20 years since you had originally written about them, and I'm curious if you're still in touch with any of those change makers.
Yes, I am. Almost all of them, actually. Except maybe Anil Prakash, because Bihar is very far, so I don't see him. But otherwise, I'm in regular touch. Of course, we lost C.V. Seshadri in 94 or 95. So that was a huge, huge loss. There's a whole chapter on him in the book. And of course, I mean, the most famous people in that book are, the people who became most famous in that book are Aruna Roy and the NKSS, you know, who went on to change history by making RTI, the right to information, such a powerful tool of democracy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, you know, seeing all of these change makers, and I guess sort of touching upon, you know, the differences in, or the evolution of technology, the way where the world is today. I mean, what do you see as sort of the components of tomorrow's change makers? You know, the young generation is coming across so many different challenges versus maybe Gandhi's times or during, you know, when the ages when you were growing up. And I'm curious, what do you see, you know, as you look forward?
Oh, I must confess that actually I'm very, very confused on the details of what all the change that we are going through, what it means. Like, I think like many people, I am completely puzzled about, you know, where this is taking us. Because I would say there are two, three major converging trends. One is that inequality and struggle for livelihoods is going to intensify very, very, very sharply. And only partly because of the artificial intelligence revolution. There are many other factors for it. And then, of course, this whole, you know, how much technology is now set to change the way we know life, whether it is robots that will, you know, be almost like human beings, or this whole business of, you know, gene splicing and gene mixing and people being able to, you know, have a custom-made baby. These are really things that I'm not yet quite able to wrap my mind around. And the third factor is the impending and accelerating ecological collapse, not just climate change. Climate change is going to just be the, you know, the most obvious part of it. So my gut feeling about people, you know, with children, and generally what to tell young people is that I think we have to cultivate and nurture resilience. People have to be much tougher. Tougher in the sense that, you know, have the strength to endure even in the face of physical hardship. And do so by building greater bonds of cooperation. Because again, if you go with the dominant narrative of the market, physical hardship, scarcity, crisis, this will all accelerate competition, make it more brutal. Then, you know, it will be a, what is it, rat race, etc., etc. Those are very likely consequences. It can go that way. But we know in India from our historical experience of communities that lived in situations of great physical scarcity like the desert of Rajasthan, where they had just a few millimeters of water every year, you know, from rainwater. But they forged the most amazing structures of cooperation and co-creation. So we have much to build on. And and that's why I feel that the service-based endeavor is so crucial. And it's not alone. I mean, these kinds of networks.
Yeah. Well, no, we appreciate that. And we appreciate your presence in this as well. You know, again, as a reminder to the callers, if you have a question, please push *6 and you'll be entered in the queue, or you can always email us at ask@servicespace.org. And we have an individual, a listener that's written in. This is Jyoti from London, who's asking that, you know, you said that the struggle against the dominant ideal of markets is driven by greed and fear, is fully engaged on many fronts. So what are some of the threads of opposition and the alternatives to the markets?
Mm-hmm. So the most important one, which is often very underrated, is, of course, what we are using just now, the internet. It is the consequence of the open source movement, the free software movement. And if Richard Stallman is listening, I apologize for using both terms in the same breath. He gets very annoyed. They're actually, the free software movement and open source are two different strands. But I think for our purposes here, I just want to say that Tim Berners-Lee, who created the World Wide Web and gifted it to the world, is a more epochal presence to our, you know, gift to our civilization than all the billions of dollars that have been made from, you know, the internet since it was created. And even today, 70% of the world's servers, I'm told, are running on open source software. So that's one very big, creative response that has changed things. The other is the rapid acceleration of organic agriculture. And organic agriculture in the hands of communities, not corporate, organic agriculture. And at the very heart of capitalism, in the financial, corporate, in the multinational world also, there are people who are struggling to find answers. You know, so there is talk, at least, of conscious capitalism and of trusteeship and of greater responsibility. The problem is that nobody knows how to change the engine while flying the plane. And that's what we are really required to do. Because, it's not, nothing is going to stop. You have to change things while they are continuing to be what they are. And so these are 2-3 of the, major examples that I know of. I'm sure there's a lot more that we could discuss if we had more time. Community currencies, that's the other very important trend. Or our own friend in Bombay, who's very much part of service space, Siddharth Salekar's foundation of this new concept. He's got a company called Sacred Capital. So whoever is interested in this should certainly look up the Sacred Capital website. That's our own homegrown neighborhood effort.
And how does that work? How does having your own...
So what Siddharth has been able to do through this endeavor is that it is an asset management exercise, but he's saying is what is required now is not asset management but asset curation. And he's saying he's trying to find ways for you to be able to invest in your local bakery, for example. You know, why should you only invest anonymously in forms of businesses where you have no say over how they run the business, what they do to make you the profit that they give you? And, sorry. And so we have a little group going just now in Bombay, which includes Siddharth, where we are discussing the possibility of how the digital revolution now makes it easier to create complementary currencies. Should I say more about complementary currencies, or do we want to move on to another question?
Yeah, no. I'm curious because I'm not sure, you know, what you mean by complementary currencies.
So it's an idea that actually has been tried during the Great Depression. You see, in many situations, there is scope for economic dynamism, which is what exchange of goods and services, but the medium of exchange is lacking, money. Okay? So what people did during the Depression, this happened on a large scale in the U.S. and in many parts of Europe, people created local currencies. And it's really like a mutual credit system or a mutual, they're actually called, one person calls them local exchange trading systems, LETs. That's one model. And the reason why they disappeared as soon as the New Deal came is the government outlawed them. Because these kinds of currencies eventually can be, if they become very prolific, they're a threat to the national currency. But now a lot of the work that is happening is not posing itself as a threat to the national currency, but saying that this is for local exchange. And it's not independent of or not in opposition to the national currency, but a local supplementary or, it's a local complement. So for example, if I'm a baker, one of you is has a hair cutting salon, the other person has a car mechanic shop, we have a token of exchange that circulates among us. The most current example in the US, well, at least some years ago it was a current example, was the Ithaca Hour, which used to operate in the town of Ithaca. But much more has happened over the last 5-6 years because of the internet and the possibility of digital, the blockchain technology has made it much easier to have such systems, and they don't even have to be local, geographically local anymore, because people could be anywhere in the world and they could have this kind of system of exchange.
Yeah, no, I've come across some of those. There are sites that where they believe life is more than cash or than traditional monetary systems, and you receive credits for doing various acts, whether it's, you know,
that's right,
teaching someone, you know, some kind of a course, and you receive credit for it, and then in return you use that sort of that credit towards something else, almost like a bartering system of sorts.
Except that it's not quite barter, because in barter you're limited by the specific thing that you have, and in this the exchange can be multidimensional, because it's not that, you know, you have to roam around with your loaves of bread till you can exchange them for onions or potatoes or a bottle of beer or whatever. There used to be one in Berkeley called Berkeley Bread. I don't know if it's still around.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
And I just want to add, it doesn't matter how raw, incomplete, and unworkable many of these things are today. Let's look at them like, let's look at this idea of complementary currencies like the, you know, where the Wright brothers were on the day when their airplane first took off at Kitty Hawk. You know how long it lasted? How long it was in the air? Not more than a minute.
Mm.
It was barely a minute. But it was enough to show them that they were on the right track. So let's keep faith in some radical experimentation.
Mm. We have another call or listener that's written in, Joseph from Seattle, and he says, I'm a novelist, and I like what you said about bowing to evil and seeing the divine in the other. Can you suggest some techniques for really stepping into the worldview of a character, especially for characters that have very uncomfortable perspectives?
Yeah, that's a really tough one. I don't have a very satisfactory answer because your question is very deep, but I will share with you something that we attempted in a group that I'm part of called Citizens for Peace. It's a volunteer group where we have been working with a very core commitment of learning to listen, that we listen for the hurt or the concern that lies behind the complaint. Now, the complaint here can mean anything, that something that we may actually find at a very visceral level, deeply offensive and hurtful, you know, as you said, that the other may be really doing and saying something that is utterly unbearable. But if we can somehow get behind that, and we can't always, okay, I can tell you from my experience that it's very difficult, I know, to overcome my sense of aversion. But we did do a workshop, of course, in which it's not a very good test case, because when you do a workshop like that, only the people who share this commitment to deep listening attend. But still, it was one where people from very different and opposing points of view were present. And we listened deeply to each other, only to find and to try and open some sense of understanding for what is the hurt, what is the concern that manifests as that complaint or that aggression. It was very enriching for everyone who was present. I just don't know, I don't have a method for how we can do this at the societal level. I think we all know that we can do it in smaller, controlled or contained group situations. I don't know if that's helpful.
No, perhaps that's what it takes, is that you have to start somewhere, and the only way that it's going to reach that upper societal level is if it starts at the individual level. I mean, I almost feel that's sort of the message that Gandhi was saying, and I'm sure many of the change makers that you've come across, where that transformation occurs at the personal level. And I guess sort of to that end, you know, when you take a look at your life and you've covered all of these incredible people, you've obviously, when you take a look at the books that inspire you, the people that inspire you, whether it's Gandhi or, you know, being influenced heavily by Ramcharitramanas reading or Vivekananda, I have to ask, you know, when you take a look at this idea of personal transformation in yourself, how would you describe that journey over the last few decades?
Struggle on slippery slopes, mostly. Two steps backwards, one step forward. No, actually, on the whole, I feel very blessed. I have been privileged and gifted with such wonderful inspirations and company. And guides and mentors. So really, I am, I feel very privileged. I have a long way to go personally. I am still, I have a tendency to get irritated very easily. I'm struggling with that a lot because I know that's a form of violence. I have impatience still in spades. So just learning every day to recommit to watching it in the hope that, not in the hope, I know this, at least this much I know, and not just hope, that diligent watching without judgment is what, I'm called to do. And as long as I stay at that post, I feel I'm justifying the carbon I'm holding.
have you picked up any tricks to the trade to overcoming some of those personal challenges? Small things that you can do in your life that you've either seen from learned examples from any of these change makers that you've come across or insights that you've developed on your own?
I think mainly just one thing, to slow down. I know that all of my challenges actually have some way, are in some way connected with a kind of haste and you know, moving or wanting things to move at a speed that may not be natural, and which is really strange because I actually love the slow life, but I have this side of me which you know, wants things to move faster or wants things done faster. So it's a strange paradox. I must confess, I haven't gotten to the bottom of that one yet. But in terms of tricks of trade, I think just if one can, and I'm not able to do this very successfully all the time, but the ability to at any moment, no matter what you're doing, where you are, to withdraw and just watch your breath. And withdraw doesn't mean, you know, leave the room and lock yourself up or something. It's just, you know, withdraw inward.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
I do have friends who've done that quite successfully.
Yeah, no, I find that to be a very helpful exercise myself. So that's great that you, that's one form of a practice that you do. So Rajni, you know, I know we're getting close to near the end of our call. I'm curious, and I think, you know, we've had a chance to talk about some of the various things that you've done over the course of your vocation. I won't say career because that's too close to profession. But I would ask, you know, what's keeping you busy these days? What's at the center of your focus today?
So my current, I'm just sort of commencing a pilgrimage to try and understand the many, many diverse efforts that are being made across the world towards nonviolence. And I'm really fascinated and you know, humbled to see how much has been done over the last 70 years since Gandhi left us. And that's really, so I'm very keen to understand that more deeply and critically, in the sense that why, after so much disappointment, how come there are people who are still diligently working for nonviolence in a very concrete, doable, practical, actionable way? So I am trying to learn from them and understand their story. That's my current mission.
It sounds like a very large mission, to be honest. And I guess, you know, how are you going about that pilgrimage? Are you actually going through or visiting around the world? Is this an internal pilgrimage that you're taking?
At the moment, I'm meeting them through the written word, because fortunately, many of them have been writing. And at some point, yes, I do need to travel and meet many of them. So I haven't figured out how that's going to happen yet. I'm working on it, and it'll come. It'll happen.
Wonderful. And I guess sort of one final question is how can we, sort of as a larger service-based community, support the work that you're doing?
Oh, you already do just by existing. You do. I will be tapping into your diverse and wonderful networks to learn, really, because I think that the whole service-based phenomenon is a big manifestation of how ahimsa, nonviolence, is not just kept alive in some token, you know, theoretical or ivory tower sense, but a living, breathing, everyday practice. And so I'm going to be learning from all of you, I feel like the whole network are fellow travelers in this pilgrimage.
Well, thank you for that, and really thank you for spending time with us today. It's been wonderful hearing all your different insights, and Rahul, thank you for the wonderful questions. You definitely dove deep across a variety of different topics, and you know, I'm just thinking about what some of the things that stood out for me during today's call. And you know, I think Rahul had asked you a question about, you know, me being able to sort of do that fluid dance between being an activist and a journalist, and maintaining that integrity. And it's, you know, when what stood is, you know, the fact that being true to the fact that being totally human and recognizing that frailty too of being totally human, and that there isn't just one truth, but there are multiple truths. And I think that that's helpful, whether, you know, you're just approaching any situation or even you're, you know, in our daily lives, and knowing that, and that could even help with our own, you know, our anger or anything that we may be confronting in our lives. So I personally appreciate you sharing some of that.
Thank you so much. And thank you both for making all this possible, and to Preeta for inviting me.
Absolutely. And so what we would like to do now is, if we could, as a sort of sign off, I'm going to take everyone off of mute, and maybe we can all do a collective thank you to Rajni as we sign off for this week. And so, count of three, we could say a big thank you together as a group. I think that'd be nice. One, two, and three. Thank you, Rajni.
Thank you. Namaste.
Thank you. Namaste, and thank you so much for having me here.
Thank you for your humility.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you all for joining us, and we look forward to you joining us next week.
Happy weekend.
Bye.
Okay.
Have a wonderful week.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.